marginal for that power level. Let's see what you got to say about all this, Mel. K2KEY with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, I'll have to defend them in a way. How do I defend them? I'll talk about a different model. Alex mentioned the Challenger model. This was the Titan DX model. A little bit different version of basically, again, the Gap product antenna. Basically, it is based on that same idea of that so-called gap in the pipe, where it gets its name from, the elevated feed, the zigzag wire in the upper section, the capacitor also up there at the top of the top section, and so on and so forth. We put one together, no more than a few hundred feet from where I am sitting right now, and the situation is that it fit the bill for a certain particular person that did not want to get too elaborate. He wanted an antenna simple enough to put, because where he wanted to mount it was on a pipe, actually mounted a pipe on a patio deck, which raised the antenna. Let's see, the patio deck being up, say, about four or five feet up, and then the pipe was additional about maybe an additional 12 feet, taking it up to about 17 feet, the base of the antenna. And this one, this is the Titan DX. It's got that counterpoise screen that I mentioned on the bottom there, that square screen. I think you looked at, Dick. And for his particular situation, it worked out to his satisfaction. Let me let it drop, and I'll say a couple more words. Now, I questioned the validity of their claims, whether this thing will outperform any dipole that this on any particular band that this antenna does work on. And that's, I did question that, but I was told that I don't really understand elevated feed. So the advantage of an elevated feed antenna versus a dipole, but I think I more or less still of the opinion that if I did take a dipole and I put it up equivalent height and maybe even angled the dipole somewhat in either a sloper or a somewhat vertical support, dropping it almost straight down, that it most likely will perform the same way, Dick. I'll give them the benefit of performance, but I can't see getting so-called gain from the antenna rover.
Mel, let me ask you something. Did you make a receiving comparison with a simple dipole with antenna? And second of all, what they're calling an elevated fed antenna is actually an asymmetrical dipole. That's all that is to it. They want to have new notation because that sells, but in fact it is an asymmetrical fed dipole. Sorry for that, Dick. Mel, go ahead. Can you tell me, if you compare that in the same place where you installed this antenna with a simple dipole or receive only?
Well, to answer your question, Alex, I went no further with it other than my personal opinion. I did not do an A-B comparison at that location because, as they say in our English, that do not rain on somebody's parade. That's basically it. The person put it together, did the right installation, checked it out, hooked it up, I mean, checked the so-called specifications of the antenna as far as standing waves from what they were specifying, and it did agree. We did get on the air with it, only CW. It was only set up for CW. And it did work, and so I could say, you don't rain on somebody's parade, Alex, over.
I understand. Just pondering if you did that for your own benefit. All right, sorry for that. Dick, go ahead.
No, I think Alex is onto something here, Mel. Mel, you're a guy with a fair amount of HF experience. You've talked to quite a few guys in quite a few countries. And there's a slim possibility that your buddy who bought this antenna also had a significant amount of HF experience. From the little bit of exposure on the air that you had of that antenna, do you have reason to believe that the signal strengths that you saw on the S meter were in the right ballpark? When the guy called CQ or he answered somebody in the pileup, do you believe he was getting approximately the right rate of return? Was he being heard with reasonable signal strength, or do you think he had to struggle quite a bit in order to get out, so to speak? Do you have a little bit of a, what I'm looking for here is anecdotal evidence of reasonable performance of the antenna in a real, on-the-air working environment? Either from your experience or from your buddy's experience, what's your gut feel as to how well the antenna was working? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I think because of the lossy cable, so long a lossy cable inside, the test has to be done on receive, because this is a high resistance cable there. So that's the receive will tell you the whole story, not the transmit. But anyway, Mel, go ahead.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm asking here. With Mel's experience, watching the S-meter on a known piece of equipment, he may have gotten a performance. I mean, if I hooked up an antenna during the time the band is opened, and if everybody sits down at S1, and that's going to scare the hell out of me, if a fair number of the guys are up at 30 over 9, I'm going to say, wow, either the band is in fantastic shape, or this antenna is really cooked.
This is K2KEY. Well, we put it up, this is a number of years ago, so we still were at a good part of the cycle. The sunspot cycle was at that time, I think, let's see, let me judge back how many years. And I'd say that we had a fairly decent part of the cycle, most likely with the solar count somewhere maybe 65, 70, 75, which is reasonable. And I did go from band to band personally and tried it out. That's basically what I wanted to do, is, you know, see what was going on from band to band. And I did work a number of stations, again, on CW. And whether or not I could have done better with a, you know, just a dipole, I am not going to say, really. But should I say something? You know, I don't want to say anything. I know I could say, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade. And I think it may not be the antenna for everybody, but I think under certain circumstances where you need what they call a small footprint antenna for a maybe somewhat difficult location that is simple enough to install and requires only one feed line, that will most likely suffice under those circumstances. I know I'm acting like a, you know, one of these Philadelphia lawyers, Dick, over.
No, I see where you're coming from, Mel. You're telling us what you know, and you're telling us what you're not sure about. Because you were doing CW contacts, and we all know that a guy radiating 1 watt of QRP signal with a medium performance antenna to a skilled operator he's talking to on CW can do some pretty good contacts. So I would have wished that you had guys and made some sideband contacts, particularly during a pileup. That would have been a little bit more testing the antenna under the heat of battle. But so you've got some evidence that the VISWR is reasonable, multiple bands, antenna can be put together, it doesn't take up a huge footprint. So it fulfills a certain need. But its traceability to the Bureau of its performance, we don't have that yet. We'd like to have it. And maybe in the future we will have it. That product that Alex bought. And Alex bought an earlier product that didn't have this this square ground plane counterpoise-like thing. And therefore its performance was lower. And maybe once you don't have a counterpoise on an antenna, quite often the coax cable that feeds it becomes hot. And when the coax cable that feeds it becomes hot, you now become cable length sensitive. Two guys can side by side on two adjacent houses install the exact same antenna, and one guy uses a longer feed line than the other, and because the feed line is doing some of the insulating, some of the radiating, if you don't have enough of a counterpoise, If the feed line is the right length and doing the right radiation, you can think the antenna is beautiful. This is very similar, let me drop, to what happens with the Ringo Ranger of Cushcraft. The Ringo Ranger is a vertical antenna that doesn't have a clearly defined counterpoise or ground plane radials. There are people who have installed the Ringo Ranger on their particular standpipe or whatever on the roof of their house, and they think it's the best thing since baked bread. There are other guys who have installed that antenna on a slightly different length of pipe, and they think the antenna is terrible. They've got a null on the horizon. So because the antenna is launching, that antenna also is launching currents into the support structure, you get different performances in different locations. And the data sheet doesn't tell you that. Maybe the guy who wrote the data sheet didn't know that at the time. So there are antennas and there are antennas. And the testing of them in comparison to a dipole is a darn good test, a lot more traceable to the Bureau. And so apparently Alex has done that test, compared it to a dipole in a similar location, and saw a significant improvement on the dipole. One more piece of evidence. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, who started this?
Okay. Let me make a final comment, Dick, here. I just pulled out my engineering notes. Every time I do something like that, I jot now jot down all the notes and whatever. Yes, it goes down to 2000. Oh, what? I can read my own writing, you know. 1991, and I've written here that the cable inside the antenna is actually a resistor that will allow you to have a low resistance on all the bands, low SWR on the low band. So it is a lossy cable I brought here to equalize the SWR across the bands. Sorry for that. I'll go quiet now.
Okay. That's your engineering notes of 1991 when you put that together. And you found it to be, because of the construction materials, quite lossy on that particular model. And loss that creates heat, that created the exploding of your capacitor and the heat in the antenna, is a significant loss mechanism that violates conservation of energy principles as far as radiating that energy into the world, into the universe. And as they say in the old country, there's nothing new under the moon. Loss is loss, and that ain't good. Let's see, Paul, look what you started. And I know you haven't gotten a nice, clean, definitive answer. Is the antenna the best thing since best bread, baked bread, or is it not so hot? You know what we know, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good.
Victor.
And yeah, in the advertisement, you know, they show a couple of names of antennas, Voyager, Nagel, and even Challenger, the one that Alex mentioned, is there. But the one they have highlighted is Titan. I guess that's the one they're pushing now. They show that they've been around 1989. But yeah, I like the idea. You know, you take a piece of inch and a quarter pipe and put that into the ground and hang this thing from it. It sounds like a good idea to me. Only because they say, you know, you could operate the entire band on all these different bands. And that's what I'm, you know, Mel pretty much answered that. He said he went, you know, tried a lot of the different bands and was able to tune up on it. You know, they claim 10, 12, 15, 17, 20, 30, 40, and even 80. So that's, you know, that sounds good to me. Especially since Mel mentioned CW, that's what primarily I would be on. So, it's a possibility. I'll definitely look into it further. And I know you've been talking about these verticals for the last couple of weeks, but I didn't realize you were talking about the gap. I just thought you were talking about generic talking about just verticals in general. But somehow I missed that. Very good. I'll look into it further. I like the idea that you don't have to put all these radials, you know, into the ground. And we'll take a look at it. And yeah, maybe this is an updated version. They've been around since 89. Here we are some 20 years later, so maybe this Titan Maybe they worked the bugs out of it. We'll look into it. I'll get on their website and give it a shot. Thanks for the info. Let me drop 1 second.
M2EO.
I just wanted to comment. Dipoles are great. I mean, I've worked the world on dipoles, 20 and 80. But I want to go on the other bands. Sometimes I can tune up on the other bands with the existing dipoles. Squirrels biting through it, and the cables over time, you wouldn't believe what happens as a tree grows. The cable gets embedded into the tree. You can't even get the thing out. It doesn't even want to move. It becomes part of the tree. It gets encapsulated inside the tree. It's amazing what happens. Things like that happen. I've tried putting even screws into the tree with a piece of wood and tying it to it that way. And as the tree expands, the screws get further apart from one another if you put them horizontally. And it'll actually split the wood. It's amazing what goes on with all these dipoles. You reset them. The storms come by. I've got by, some 20 years with this, but over that now. I figured maybe we'll try one of these verticals. Thanks for the info, Mel, Dick, and everybody. Alex, back to you, Dick. WS1.
Rich recognized, and there was another person checking in earlier. Let's stand by and find out who that earlier person was. We're going to wait until the machine drops. K2RIW. I heard a weak voice in there, one transmission before Rich. Rich, I wonder if you have experience with the Titan or similar GAP products. And by the way, Paul, over the last couple of weeks, we have been discussing vertical antennas of both kinds. Homebrew, half-wave-like, pure vertical antennas fed at one end or fed in the center, as well as the Titan and GAP antenna, elevated feed in. We have been discussing all of the above. And we don't have the definitive word on it, but at least we're gathering a fair amount of anecdotal evidence of those who have been there, done that, touched it, and used them, and are either moderately pleased or moderately displeased. We've had all of the above. Rich, N2EO, wonder what experience you've got with a similar product. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I think I told you, and I'll just bring it up again. I'm using the Cushcraft R8. And if anything, I think the R8 is underrated, undersold. It's a very good antenna. I've had it now, I guess, 8 or 9 years. It's an electrical half-wave. It uses 7 48-inch counterpoise radials at the bottom. And it stands 22 feet high. And I have it in the backyard on a 12-foot section of water pipe, which is cemented into the ground. Cushcraft had told me that unless you're looking to work ground wave, like 10 meters or something, there's absolutely no need to put it up very high. They told me you just wanted to get it up high enough that people don't walk into it. And it works very well. Like I say, Dick, I think the best testimonial I can give you was after I bought it, I was worried because Cushcraft, the company, was sold and resold, and I was worried that they might stop making it, so I've got a brand new spare sitting in my attic still in a sealed box. I mean, it's a very good antenna. It's not a beam, but I have worked a lot of DX with it. I also have I subsequently put up a 75-meter half-wave inverted V, which runs from the front of the property to the back. And I use the R8 does not cover 75 meters. It covers 6 to 40. I've used it on 40-meter CW and 20-meter sideband, and it does a very good accounting of itself, especially if Paul is interested. It works extremely well on 40 CW. And I worked into the Middle East and elsewhere on 20 meters. And on 20 meters, I've made comparisons between it and the 75-meter dipole, which is fed with lateral line. And I would say half the time the vertical is better, the other half the time the dipole is better on 20. Depends upon the angle the signal's coming in. And I can rapidly switch from one antenna to the other. I think it's worth the money. I think if you can't get something up that takes up, you need something compact, simple, one feed line, it works well. I think it's a better antenna than the gap. It just looks, from the picture of the gap, it looks more mechanically stable. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, and 2EO.
I heard a weak signal that checked in there. I'm going to, in two transmissions, I'm going to go in and look for that person again. At the time that you purchased the antenna, and you were so pleased with it, you bought a second one, at the time of purchase, what was the approximate price you paid at that time, Rich? Go ahead.
Yeah, they get a lot of money. This antenna is, I think, about $400-something. I think it went up since then. By the way, I put all kinds of power into it, Dick. You know, that amplifier I rebuilt with the two tubes. And I'm amazed I haven't blown it up. And I've been doing that now for 2 years.
I might have a comment.
Go ahead, Alex.
This is another secret kept from us for 1,000 years. If you're not looking for a beam, then the best antenna you can make for $5 is 100 feet of wire that you hang it in the trees wherever you can, fit it back on itself as a loop with a balloon, and here you go. It costs you $5, and you have the best antenna in the world. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, when it comes to cost effectiveness, a high mounted dipole, horizontal and or vertical, is hard to beat. And cost effectiveness, wow, that does a lot. But when it comes to 80 meters, for instance, or 40 meters, some people don't have enough real estate to put up the wire, and they don't have the confidence to make a compacted version of a dipole on any of those bands. And I can tell you for a fact that if you can tolerate the narrow bandwidth of operation, you can squeeze down a dipole on any of your bands to a rather small physical size by zigzagging, loading coils, top hat capacitors, various techniques. You can squeeze the antenna down, and you will, at the tuned frequency, get 95% of the performance. The effective capture area does not go down. And if you use the right kind of materials, the gain does not go down, even though everyone believes it does. Done a whole bunch of lab experiments on higher frequency UHF versions of these dipoles where I squeezed down the size and went and measured the gain with good equipment. It's there. And in the cases when I found the gain wasn't there, I put the UHF antenna with compacted techniques in front of a thermal imaging camera, and right away I found out who was eating my lunch. The part that got hot would glow in the photograph on that thermal imaging camera. And if I wanted confirmation, I reached over there and put my finger on that part, and I brought my finger away real fast saying, I feel the heat. I believe. I know where the power is going. So, there's ways step by step we can, even though you might live in a difficult environment, your landlord and your supervisor says, no, you're not going to put an antenna on the roof of this building, and you've got to do everything inside of your apartment. Or maybe after dark you can hang it out the window if it's a multi-floor building and so on. There's various ways. There's a whole series of articles. And I just recently found the book that I had misplaced on stealthy techniques for installing antennas in difficult environments. There are various books you can buy on that exact subject. Antennex, I think, is one of the people who sell such books. So don't give up. Let me find out who was trying to check in. I'm not sure if it was Joe or somebody else. We'll wait long...
Repeater, time out.
We're going to wait long enough for that person to check in, whoever it was, who made multiple attempts. K2RIW standing by.
Good evening. Alpha Foxtrot 6, Charlie Victor in Huntington Beach, California.
Okay, Alpha Foxtrot 6, Charlie Victor, Huntington Beach, California. Please start off with your name, sir, and then tell us whether or not you've got comments, questions, whatever. And what's the weather like today in Huntington Beach? Of course it was a nice sunny day. You got it, sir. I'm standing by for Alpha Foxtrot 6. Charlie Victor, go right ahead.
Correct. It was a beautiful, picture-perfect day. We spent most of the afternoon in the low to mid-70s with just a slight, slight ocean breeze. It was just gorgeous. Anyway, have enjoyed listening to this net for a while, but have a question. A few moments ago, you specifically mentioned the Ringo Ranger. First version, they came out with a Ringo Ranger 2, which added three ground radials. So I guess my question was that done basically to correct the problem of the earlier design? And on another note, my HF antenna is a Cushcraft R7, which, like the R8, is a trap vertical. And I have that mounted up about 10 feet on a single piece of TV antenna mast. And I also have received excellent results and excellent signal confirmations from most of the United States, South America, and occasionally into Europe. And in an area where I'm a bit space challenged, it does a very good job, and I wouldn't hesitate to buy another one of those either.
Very fine, Donald. That was Alpha Foxtrot 6 Charlie Victor from Huntington Beach. Sounds like he's quite pleased with his R7. And I guess I don't have direct knowledge, Donald, about the later version of the Ringo Ranger that added the ground plane radials. But I strongly suspect that Cushcraft did get feedback about the fact that various people would mount the original Ringo Ranger without the ground plane radials on either shorter or longer pieces of pipe and had either good or bad performance accordingly because it was launching currents into the support structure. And whether or not that support structure was the right electrical length to support the antenna pattern on the horizon is what happens. If, for instance, you've got too long or too short, I'm not sure which, and it's probably eigenvalues here of proper operation, you know, individual groups of lengths, where the additional signal radiated by the support structure either will be in phase or out of phase with the signal you wish to get onto the horizon of that antenna, and hopefully the antenna has sort of a pancake antenna pattern, and you don't want that lobe on the horizon to be above or below the horizon, which is something that can happen, by the way, with a superstation master that's on the wrong frequency, even though you may be able to live with the standing wave ratio of being on the wrong frequency. So I strongly suspect, as you can tell, that the radials were added to aid that sensitivity to mounting structural length. Every antenna needs a counterpoise. Let me drop and I'll explain that one. Just because the antenna you are using, either the manufacturer or you have done a heroic job of impedance matching the antenna so that it gives you 50.0 ohms resistive impedance with no reactive impedance. That's the most ideal antenna to hang on the end of your transmission line, if it's a 50 ohm transmission line. Just because your antenna has no apparent reflected power on your VISWAR detecting device in the shack doesn't mean that the power simply flows down the transmission line and jumps off the antenna and goes into space. Every antenna you and I have ever used of finite length, something other than a rhombic or a beverage, which are multiple wavelengths long, I'm not talking about those antennas. Every one of the, and that, by the way, is called a traveling wave antenna. That beverage or that rhombic is called traveling wave. But every one of the antennas that we use, like dipoles and driven elements of Yagis and whatever, they are standing wave structures. That means in the antenna itself, in that radiating element of the antenna, the RF energy that you apply is a little bit like the ringing of a bell. the energy bounces back and forth from left to right side of that antenna something like 20 times before it gets radiated into space. RF energy is tough. RF radiation is tough. It's not as easy as you think. Just because you've got a good impedance match doesn't mean the energy is just jumping out of, off the antenna in one step. It's bouncing back and forth something like 20 times. Obvious by the fact that you tune a little bit higher or a little bit lower in frequency, and the VSWR climbs precipitously. That means the antenna is becoming inductive or capacitive, respectively. What's happening with that energy that bounces back and forth 20 times in the antenna is that resonance is the phenomenon where the bouncing energy stays in step on each bounce. If the antenna is electrically too long, because you've gone to a lower frequency, a higher frequency, that means that the bouncing energy no longer stays in step. It starts becoming inductive. It lags in phase. You call it an inductive antenna. The bounces go out of step. That's the mechanism by which the antenna becomes inductive. You didn't suddenly walk over there and plug...
Repeater, time out.
You didn't suddenly walk over there and plug in an inductor. The antenna acted like an inductor when you tune to the higher frequency because the bounces fall out of step. We all forget about what radiation really is of a standing wave structure. It's a high-Q resonator. And that signal is bouncing back. The energy that you're applying, only a small percentage of it is radiated on each bounce. It takes multiple bounces for it to fully become radiated. If you wanted to make a cartoon, you could say that your transmission line, your transmitter, the feed line, is taking that RF energy, applies to the antenna, kicks it in the tail 20 times in a row before it finally decides to leave. It's an exaggeration, but it gets the point across. Somehow we've all forgotten that phenomenon. Once you realize that all this bouncing and in-step or out-of-step is taking place, you suddenly realize what's going on when you follow that procedure I'm talking about of lengthening the antenna to raise the resistive component and then re-resonating it with a shunt capacitor to get rid of the reactants. You're electronically making the antenna the right length so all the bouncing stays co-phase, in-step, and the length determines whether or not you see a 1-ohm impedance or a 1,000-ohm impedance and everything in between. The resistive component, you've got complete freedom of adjusting the resistive component by doing nothing but adjusting the length of the dipole-like structure or monopole-like structure. That's the secret we've all been revealing to each other tonight. And yes, you get reactants left over, but don't let that scare the heck out of you. You can easily get rid of reactants mechanically simply in a shunt capacitor manner. It doesn't have to be a series capacitor. There's a slight disadvantage of making the shunt impedance matching or reactance correcting capacitor. To use it in a shunt manner, there's a slight disadvantage. It creates interaction between the length tuning and the capacitance tuning. But since the bottom line of the interaction is just a couple of more steps and you arrive at home plate, it doesn't matter. And mechanically, it's simpler. If you were a purist and you understand the way the impedance matching works, you would think you want to put the capacitor in series. Mechanically, that's more difficult, particularly for tuning it. Tuning this procedure I'm talking about, these very simple tuning tools, chunks of copper tape or aluminum tape on the end of a wooden stick, held in the right...
Repeater, time out.
With that tuning tool held in the right spot, you immediately find out whether you want the antenna to be longer or shorter. And with another piece of copper tape across the feed terminals, you will easily find out exactly what capacitance it wants in order to give a perfect non-reactive impedance match. And that's one of the main definitions of resonance. No reactive component left. That's a fancy way of saying you're making all the bounces fall in step. Because reactive component really means that the bounces are either lagging or leading the desirable bounce phasing characteristic. That's what radiation of a standing wave structure is, bouncing RF energy. I have never read those words in any respected antenna book in my 35 years of experience of building antennas as a professional. I have never read anything like those words. I'm very disappointed that that secret has been kept from us all these years. I own 35 books on the subject of antennas. Not one of them says those basic words. I'm very disappointed by that. It's time the next author correct that. That's a strongly felt opinion. You guys have probably got lots of opinions about what you've heard so far tonight. There's a little bit of emotion involved here, as you can tell. I'm going to stand by long enough to see if anybody wants to add or subtract from all of the above. Opinions accepted. K2RIW and the TechNet. We're listening.
I guess Norrie from Henderson, Nevada is checking in tonight, are they?
Possibly not, Joe. Hey, Joe, what do you hear? And what do you think of all this, Jazz? W-H-2-R-Y-Y, I think that was. K2-R-I-W.
I think we got a good bunch of antenna experts on the net tonight.
Well, experts, you know what an expert is, Joe? That's somebody that used to spurt, whatever that means. That's a relative word. We've got people with a fair amount of experience, hands-on experience. They've touched, felt, watched them smoke, whatever. They've really used antennas. That's the kind of experience you're hearing about tonight. The gathering of this particular clan, we're comparing our mutual likes, dislikes, misery, and whatever about antennas. And hopefully we're sharing knowledge that 90% of it is accurate. No guarantee. You get what you pay for. You haven't paid very much for this, so the price was right, and we hope that 90% of the data you've heard tonight is accurate, or at least it's close to a kind of a truth as to how Mother Nature works. And as Alex has brought to my attention again today, what really happens? How does that signal get off of that antenna and radiate into space? We've all got some fancy words about the ether, the ionosphere, RF radiation, radiation efficiency, bandwidth, beamwidth, front-to-back ratio, gain. We got lots of fancy words. What really happens? I mean, when I was listening to those Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16, while they're on the lunar surface, I sat there with that homebrew equipment, that 12-foot dish that you can read about in the, I guess that was the August issue of QST Magazine, 1972. You can see the picture of me in front of that dish, and I'm listening to those astronauts. They're radiating a 10-watt signal at 2,000 megacycles from the moon. I realized that not one single electron from that antenna on the moon left that antenna. Some kind of a wave left the lunar surface, went through that 240,000 miles, arrived at my receiving antenna in Farmingdale, Long Island, New York, and it eventually moved the S-meter and moved the loudspeaker. Through that extremely hard vacuum of space, energy was transmitted. We call it an electromagnetic wave. Fancy words. What really was it? Not one single electron. Yeah, locally there was a magnetic field created by the feed horn that got reflected off that parabolic dish, and it got transmitted through that space. And with a similar piece of receiving equipment, I picked up that resultant signal. Is it the magnetic field that got radiated?
Repeater, timeout.
As you can see, I've got a considerable doubt. I mean, from experiential evidence, we all know what an antenna does. It creates action at a distance. But what really is the mechanism by which the energy conveys itself through space? Well, we got a bunch of fancy equations, Maxwell's equations. We got the pointing vector. We got watts per square meter. We got radiated power. Watts, energy, joules. We got all the fancy words. We got methods of making measurements of what we think is happening. But what really is that wave? It doesn't contain one single electron. It contains photons. We got a word for it. It's a little bit like when you go to your physician, he's not sure what you've got, and he says, you've got a virus. Well, you've had a pronouncement, you've got a medication that he recommended, you paid him some money, you walked away, and you think you're happy. He may not know. I, as a radio engineer, from experiential evidence, I can use the words, I can make the measurements, I know what's going to happen, I can predict it ahead of time, but I'm not quite sure. I got this vague feeling. I don't know what's happening. I kind of wish I knew. All the books that I read on the subject don't make it clear. What is that photon of RF energy? It isn't an electron. What is a photon? It's a word. It's a method of conveying energy. But I don't know what it is. I haven't seen it. I can't smell it. I can measure it six ways from Sunday.
Amen.
Okay. It's some kind of an emitted energy. Yes, good words, but I don't know what it is. Anybody want to add or subtract any comments from this crazy philosophical discussion I got into tonight? We're going to go on to some real subjects now. But anybody wants to add or subtract from this, give us your words right now, K2RIW.
KB2MAR.
Yeah, Dick, I have a question, WHCDL.
MAR too?
I heard MAR and I heard CDL, in that order. MAR first, start off with your name, sir, and then tell us your comment.
Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo, and in here is Gabe. And basically, I was wondering, when you say photons, I understand that light and electromagnetic waves travel at the same speed, but how could you tell electromagnetic wave that goes to the same consists of photons when light is photons itself? Are photons the same type of that to you?
Yeah, I see where you're going, Gabe. Let me show you the problem. When Alex, N2NNU, not too long ago, was using one of his RF energy acoustic wave transmitting devices, a phased array, and making ultrasound measurements on biological materials, at times he was doing that at, say, 6 megacycles. That was 6 megacycles of acoustic energy. Okay? I can take 6 megacycles and I can put it into a dipole. I can rearrange the dipole and go up to 60 megacycles. I can go up to 600 megacycles. I can go up to 6 gigahertz and so on. If I eventually get up to 10 to the 14 hertz, that's in the middle of the optical band, if you could see the energy coming out of that antenna, it would look green to your eye. That green energy your eye sees, yes, that is pure optical energy. I go to half the frequency of that green energy. Instead of 550 nanometers, I go to 5,000 nanometers. You and I call that infrared. It's an electromagnetic wave. I go to 1/10 of that frequency. You and I would call it far infrared. Still, it's an electromagnetic wave. Consists of photons. I go to 1/10 of that frequency, and maybe you and I are going to call it 60 gigahertz or 6 terahertz. You and I would call that far infrared or sub-millimeter. It's a continuous spectrum. Certain portions of that frequency range, you and I call it optical. Other portions, we call it sub-millimeter, and then sub-millimeter, and then millimeter, and then micrometer, and then centimeter, and then meter. It's the exact same spectrum. Yes, the energy per photon gets weaker and weaker as you go lower and lower in frequency. It's still the exact same continuous electromagnetic spectrum. There is no sharp dividing line where you suddenly leave the world of RF and enter the world of optical. And if you go to even higher frequencies than optical, you and I call it ultraviolet, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, soft X-rays, hard X-rays, cosmic rays. Nothing has changed but the frequency. The exact same spectrum, and the photons get stronger and stronger per photon.
Repeater, timeout.
As you go higher and higher in frequency, the energy per photon, energy equals H nu. As you go higher and higher in frequency, smaller and smaller in wavelength, the energy per photon increases, but you didn't suddenly leave the electromagnetic spectrum. You never, starting off at 60 hertz or 50 hertz, power line frequency, it is a frequency that can be radiated into space. It's part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's all continuous. There is no sharp line. We have created artificial fences here. Certain frequency regions, you and I call it optical because of our experience. And we call it infrared. We call it millimeter wave. We've erected phony fences. Those fences are not real. We've come up with vocabulary to make each other understand what we're talking about. We're all talking about the exact same electromagnetic spectrum. I know it's going to take a while for that crazy concept to sink in, Gabe. See if it made a little bit of sense to you the first time you heard it. KB2MAR, I think it is. K2LIW in the deck net. Gabe, I'm Gabe is also from Yonkers, but I'm sorry to say, Gabe, that particular transmission was almost unreadable, became extremely weak. So something changed on your transmitter or something changed at the repeater site. I'm going to come back to you after we go to Andy and give you another chance to repeat what you just said. You either got to aim the antenna a little bit differently or go a little bit higher power. We didn't copy that last one. WA2CDL, the guy who's the technical maven for this repeater. Hey, Andy, what do you think of all this jazz tonight? K2LAW.
It's way over my head. I just got on, but I got to go to work tomorrow. I start my new job. When you get a chance, I have a question regarding coax cable. Are you up to taking a question regarding that? Because I want to clarify something.
We've been discussing antennas and feed lines tonight. You're essentially right on subject. And I've gone on to a couple of tangents of philosophy of antennas and radio. So, in my usual soapbox manner, go ahead with your coax question, Andy.
Oh, it's a pretty simple one, but I haven't done enough research to see where the books are that'll give me the numbers. We all know that coax cable has what they call a propagation delay, or we also know it as velocity factor, because, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you launch a signal into a piece of coax cable, from the instant you launch it and the time it goes through the cable until it leaves the cable, there's a delay because of the capacitance effect of the cable. In my opinion, what I've read, a coax cable, you could draw a schematic of it, and isn't it, and I'm questioning it, and then you'll correct me, isn't it a series resistance and a series inductance with a bunch of, like, little capacitors to ground shunting across it from the center conductor to the shield through the dielectric? That's, I'm making that statement, and I'm sure you will agree with me on that. Is that right so far? And then we'll continue.
Yes, it is. I'm going to add a couple of words to that one, Andy. You can make a simulated coaxial cable, and you can make a essentially lossless simulated coaxial cable by having a ladder network where you've got a series inductor, a shunt capacitor, followed by another series inductor and a shunt capacitor. You keep doing that over and over again, and that cable that you are simulating in that manner becomes closer and closer to reality as you make each one of the physical lengths and electrical magnitude of those inductors and capacitors smaller and smaller. As you put more and more of them per inch, you get closer and closer to the coax cable, and eventually you'll suddenly realize, hey, I've got an outer conductor, a center conductor, and I've got dielectric in between. And now I've carried it all the way to infinity as far as the sizes of its components. When a wave travels in free space, the speed of light, we've all heard it as 186,000 miles per second. That's hard to relate to it. In the world I live in, where I've got good instrumentation that can make nanosecond measurements, I know the speed of light is 1 nanosecond per foot and in free space. And if a signal has to go through 2 feet, through free space, I know it will get there in damn close to 2.0 nanoseconds. That's free space. You and I know that because of the dielectric constant of our cable, the plastic that's in there, let me drop. When in doubt, if you know the dielectric constant of the plastic, let's assume that you've chosen plastic that has a dielectric constant of 4. That really means when you put it between two plates, the capacitance of between the two plates just went up by 4 to 1 because of that nature of that plastic. If I've got 4 to 1 dielectric constant plastic, I take 1 over the square root of that. 1 over the square root of 4 is 2. I know that if my theoretical plastic has 4 dielectric constant, and I've used that to fill up the airspace between center conductor and shield of my coax cable, I will have a velocity factor of exactly 1/2, 0.5, compared to free space. That means now it takes 2 nanoseconds per foot for the signal to go down that cable. The coax cable you and I buy, RG8, has a velocity factor of 66%, 0.66 nanoseconds per foot through the cable, one nanosecond per foot. Oh, I get it backwards. It only goes 0.66 feet per nanosecond. It's moving slower. 0.66 feet per nanosecond in the cable, the RG8 you and I can buy, and one nanosecond per foot in free space. It goes slower. And as you use higher and higher dielectric constant material, it'll go slower and slower. When you were simulating it with series inductors and shunt capacitors, as you make those capacitors bigger, the wave will travel slower. And it'll be simultaneous, a lower impedance cable, unless you readjust the inductors. Make the inductors a little bit smaller, make the capacitors a little bit bigger, and you've made slower velocity factor.
Stop right there a second.
Go right ahead.
Because here's what I want to clarify, and you're on the right track. Because they state the cable as having a velocity factor as what you said, for RG8 it's 0.66. But they also state, if you look at the specs, on the capacitance per foot, just like you were explaining. But what they don't state, at least what I've seen in specifications, is the fact that doesn't the velocity factor change with the length of the cable? This is a question. And because you are, let's make a little experiment. If you take a 1 foot length piece of cable, and you take a 100 foot length piece of cable, and you connect the T connector to one side, and you launch a signal into both cables at the exact same time, if you look at the cable, or rather, if you look at the signal coming out of the cable from the 1 foot length and compare it to the 100 foot length, wouldn't there be a difference in delay? Wouldn't there be a delay, phase delay between the two because one cable is longer than the other? So the velocity factor would change because of that, or am I wrong?
Yeah, not quite right on that one, Andy. Let's start off with free space. I know that that wave will go across 1 foot of free space between my transmitting antenna and my receiving antenna. And by the way, on my desk, at my place of business, is a transmitting antenna and a receiving antenna, which I sometimes, at a microwave frequency, separate them by 18 inches, 1.5 feet. Sometimes I separate them by 3 feet, depending on what test I'm doing. And I got a bunch of anechoic material around to absorb the reflections off the tables and everything else. I've got a miniature antenna range at my desk, at my place of business, that I have used for 5 solid years. And you'd be amazed how many microwave antennas were developed and patented on that yucky antenna range. Very simple equipment, if you know what you're doing, can do some pretty elaborate testing. So, I've got the two antennas, one transmitting antenna or receiving antenna, in free space, across my desk, separated by 1 foot. I can make a bunch of measurements and confirm that the signal goes from one to the other in 1 nanosecond. I separate the 1 foot distance and I make it 2 feet. The signal now takes 2 nanoseconds to go to 2 feet. The nanoseconds per foot didn't change. The time delay changed, but I made the distance longer. I doubled the distance, and it exactly doubled the time domain. I've done that experiment probably once every week. I measure time delay. I'm really measuring phase, but it's the equivalent. By the same token, if I've got 1 foot of coax cable, let me make it 0.66 feet of coax cable. The signal will go down there in 1 nanosecond. It'll go from one end to the other. If I double the distance of the cable, 0.66 times 2, which is what? 1.32 feet, I guess it is. It'll take 2 nanoseconds to go down there. I'm not changing the nanoseconds per foot. I'm changing the number of feet, same number of nanoseconds per foot. It's going to take no more nanoseconds. It's a linear relationship. So far, you with me, Andy? W2CDL, K2LAW?
No. I don't get it. I'm missing something. But I have to go because I got to get to work tomorrow. I'll have to talk to you on the phone about it. There's something that's missing. I'm not getting. It's not clear.
Okay, let me make it more clear. I've got a puddle of water out in front of your house right now. I drop a pebble into the northern end of that puddle, and I watch a wave travel to the south. I'm going to pick some numbers out of the air here. Let's assume that that wave travels across the puddle 1 foot per second. If I do it with a bigger puddle, so that now there's 2 feet of distance between the northern end and the southern end, it'll take 2 seconds for the wave to get there. The exact same wave velocity. I've dropped a pebble in the puddle, and I've watched the wave spread out. The splash from that puddle created a wave, and I watched that wave spread out. If I've got twice as much distance for that wave to travel through, it's going to take twice as much time. That wave doesn't know how long the puddle is. The coax cable doesn't know how, the signal going into the cable doesn't know how long the cable is. It goes down that cable at a fixed velocity. At a fixed velocity, call it miles per hour if you like. If I make the cable twice as long, it will take twice as much time for the signal to travel down that cable. It travels at a constant velocity in the cable. It travels at a constant velocity through the puddle. It travels at a constant velocity in free space, a wave in free space. Each one has its own phase velocity, wave traveling velocity, but it's a linear relationship of total time delay to cover the distance versus the number of feet of distance it's got to cover. A linear relationship. Double the distance, you must double the time for the wave to get there. The V2, okay.
But that's a little confused. I got that. That's clear. So how could the velocity factor be the same? What is the definition of velocity factor? Let's start with that.
Let me call it miles per hour. If you travel at 30 miles per hour to go from your house to my house and assume that we are 30 miles apart, it's going to take you 1 hour to get here. If I moved over to Paul's house, WS2N, which is 60 miles, it's going to take you 2 hours instead of 1 hour. You're traveling the exact same speed. Velocity is distance over time. So it's going to take you twice as many hours to get 60 miles as it does 30 miles if you're traveling at the exact same speed.
And what determines velocity factor?
Capital H, E. Why does a wave travel at the speed of light?
No, I know what you're saying. But what I mean is velocity factor is determined by the capacitance, inductance, and resistance of the cable, correct? And the dielectric of the material, which determines the capacitance of the material. Is that right?
The resistance of the cable almost doesn't matter. Forget that one.
I got you.
So, the velocity is determined directly by 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant of the plastic that fills the transmission line.
And that's a constant no matter what length the cable is.
You got it.
Right, but what about the capacitance per foot?
Okay. The capacitance per foot is constant. If at a low frequency measurement, like a 60 hertz rate, I measure the capacitance of 1 foot of cable, and I get maybe 27 picofarad, and if I then measure 2 feet of cable, I'll get 54 picofarad, twice the number of picofarad.
All right, just stop there for a second. I'm just trying to clarify this. So in other words, the velocity is actually the speed, and the speed doesn't change going through the cable. The capacitance changes, but the fixed velocity factor doesn't change. That's where it's a little bit unclear, and I see the point that you're making. I got that.
If you don't press harder on that accelerator and go faster, when you go twice as much distance, it's going to take you twice as much time. When you have 1 foot of cable, and when you simulated the cable with a bunch of series inductors and a bunch of shunt capacitors, you had a given number of capacitors per foot. When you use 2 feet of cable, you got twice the number of capacitors. That's why there's twice the number of picofarads on twice as much cable.
So it's going to... I'm interrupting purposely because I'm in a hurry, because it's going to take a longer period of time for those caps to charge because you got more in series, more in parallel with each other, so you have a larger capacitor over a given length of cable. So it's going to take longer for it to charge, which will slow down the velocity, slow down the speed of the signal through the cable. Is that right?
Good guess, but no. at a 60 hertz rate, a 1 foot of cable or a 2 foot of cable, because your frequency is so low, there isn't even one complete cycle